Welcome to Everyone Deserves Sunshine. I'm Diana.
And I'm Anusha. We're the girls in the crease.
This is episode 6. We're talking about anti-dystopia today.
We're like really just diving right in. You know what I mean?
We're jumping in.
None of that like setting it up, lubrication.
Today we're doing what Jacob Tierney did. We're scrapping the prep.
You're not watching how it gets made. You're just seeing the final product.
Correct. And you know what? Correct. That is important here today that because we have a lot to talk about. And
we
also have an interview later. So we got to get started. So we wanted to talk about anti-dystopia because, I mean, I don't know. It's weird, right? Because the world is so great and we really just like live in a perfect utopian world. So like, why would we need anti-dystopia? In all seriousness, we wanted to talk about anti-dystopia because the world is shit. And it is quite dystopian, starting to feel more so every single day.
Uh-huh.
And this genre of romance and the show specifically gave us so much joy in a world where joy is so scarce, right?
I want to say I like that, but I actually don't like that at all. I don't like that
Which part do you not like?
All of it. But I understand what you're saying. This show in this moment has brought so many people like this incredible sense of joy. And we talk a lot about what's our favorite words, nuance, earnestness, authenticity, all of that, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. So I just want to read something that Jacob Tierney said that also just speaks to the earnestness, authenticity, and nuance. And obviously, I'm reading this after I've watched the show in its entirety, maybe a couple of times. So here's what he says about this romance in general. This is a genre that women love and write and read and are primary consumers of. It just doesn't get treated with a lot of respect, and nor do the people who make it, nor do the people who adapt it. So I think what they, as in the people, are responding to, or at least I hope, is the fact that we came to this pretty full-hearted, and as fans and as people who want to honor this material and want to honor the genre and make it as romantic as we can. That's certainly what I wanted to do.
Oh, I love that.
I know. I love that word, full-hearted. You know, I feel like full hearts are a rarity now. I think all of us feel that sense of like drain, that there's not even room to think about things that are joyful in nature.
Perhaps not that there's not room, but like it almost feels a little bit like guilty to consume media that's joyful, right? Because you're like, how can you possibly enjoy something when the world's on fire? And I love that he thought of it this way because like, you know how like, side note, like I don't like cooking. I hate cooking. Like I hate cooking so much, right? You're looking at me funny, but you're going to understand where I'm going with this, right? And some of my friends love cooking. They love cooking and their families always say like, whatever you make is delicious. And then whatever I make is like either burnt or like just not good. And I think it's because, you know, people who love cooking put love into their cooking. And so when you're eating it, you're like, oh my God, this is delicious because it's made with love. Mm-hmm. And that is how Jacob Tierney made the show. Mm-hmm. It was made with love, right? And that's why it's so good and people are enjoying it so much. You can taste the love, and that's how you can taste the love in people's cooking, not in my cooking, because I'm not making it with love. I'm making it with like, I cannot believe I fucking have to make dinner again tonight. But other people who love it, like it tastes good, right?
You're now going with non sequitur analogies. I really like this for us. You mentioned guilt, Diana, and the other thing that makes me feel guilty is the escapism that I naturally crave during these times. My brain wants to leave. You want to check out of the existential dread.
Yeah.
But that also means sometimes you check out of like real life happening in front of you.
Like things you need to fucking
do. Yeah. And things also that are important to like tether you to the world, you know, in a good way. Mm. And you miss it because you're like seeking this like almost high, you know, escapism high.
I am still like very much into escapism with all of this. Like I've definitely been a little bit like escaping my everyday responsibilities in the world. I think most of it has to do with the fact that it is bringing all of us so much joy because we're so used to not feeling that much joy all the time, right?
If you escape and you return depleted, to the real world. That is ostensibly not helpful if you have responsibilities. But if you escape and you come back more rejuvenated, which I would say, like, for you, like, having known you for this long and having worked with you in other places where our creativity and our very specific skill set is needed, I see a difference in the way your creativity has been utilized and exploded with this, where you look and seem happier. You know what I mean? That, I think, is good. So today we're going to be talking to Zhenka, who wrote this absolutely fabulous and thought-provoking article called Heated Rivalries, Anti-Dystopian Art. Welcome, Zhenka. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and tell us how you got into the show.
So way back in the day, I was originally a film student, which sort of ties into how we landed here. I moved to LA. I worked in film like a little tiny bit, but pretty quickly got into producing music festivals and nightlife events. And I did that for like about a decade. And then I was in marketing and advertising. And then I ended up in technology doing user experience design, whether it's film, whether it's music festivals, whether it's applications on your phone, it's all experience design. And so that is kind of a lens through which I look at both what I do professionally and then also the way that I look at culture and the entertainment that we see. And that kind of led me to writing this essay. After I wrote it, I looked back and like a year ago, I had started like posting about how I was seeing this trend of just constant brutality and violence and things you don't even, it would be comedies. You'd be watching a comedy and suddenly there'd be gun violence that would be ostensibly, supposedly for laughs. Or I was watching this show called Wheel of Time, and there was, this particularly really stood out to me. There was just like this almost pornographic sequence of two women killing each other over and over and over in like various ways. It's like a dream sequence where they keep dying, but it was just like such a luxuriation in the graphicness, the visual lushness of watching this like intense violence and brutality, and it was presented in the guise of entertainment and beautifully shot, and you're really supposed to react to it in this kind of like enjoyment way, but what it was showing you and depicting was just incredibly disturbing. And that's just kind of like throughout all of our culture, throughout of all of our entertainment, all of our media, and we actually almost take it as a given. This was already things that were on my mind a year ago and before that, and then when the show came out, when I saw it, it was like just a referendum on everything that I had been thinking about in this vein. And to your question about how I got into the show, how I found it. So initially, you know, I've been seeing ads. I think we all had sort of been like seeing ads like on Instagram or something, like, oh, Heated Rivalries. I'm like, I thought it was either going to be one of two things. I thought it was either going to be like this really saccharine Hallmark kind of like young adult sort of thing, or I thought it was going to be Euphoria. Like, I thought it was going to be this, like, really bleak, depressing, like, something that was going to make you feel like shit after you watched it. And I saw somebody post something about it on Threads that piqued my curiosity. I'm like, this reaction to it seems like not either one of those things that I think that it is. And then I watched it, and, like, you know, the rest is history.
I never made it through Euphoria. I watched, like, 3 or 4 episodes, and I couldn't. It was so dark. I couldn't do it. I know people love it. I know people are obsessed with it. I felt the same way about Game of Thrones. I couldn't do it.
Totally. So, I can't. Yeah. I didn't watch either one. I watched two episodes of Euphoria for those exact same reasons, because I think I was so aware about like of seeing these dystopian tropes in everything we're seeing. Is like, so the other part of this is that I also studied hypnosis and hypnotherapy. And so I understand what these visions are doing to us in a kind of like a trance-like way, like what kind of state they're putting us into and what kind of vision they're suggesting to us. Mm-hmm. And I just don't want to be hypnotized into that. Like, I don't want to go into those worlds.
Can you tell us what dystopia means to you and what anti-dystopia means to you?
Dystopia, I think, you know, the sort of the very generic kind of vision, like idea that comes to mind when you say that word is like a sci-fi future. But if you think about things like Minority Report, like how much of that has just become a roadmap for where we've ended up?
Oh yeah, right.
So it seems Absolutely. Speculative, but that vision primes us to accept that that is what the future is going to be. And so mm-hmm. when it arrives, like, well, no, here it is.
Here we are.
And so that's one part of it. But the other part of it is that I also think there are shows that aren't necessarily science fiction. They're not speculative. They're like Euphoria. They're set in a world that is like ostensibly like the world we're in now, but mm-hmm. they're so full of cynicism. Mm. They are like characters experiencing a genuine human connection or emotion, even when that does somehow manage to like squeak through, is rewarded with pain and punishment and how silly to have expected connection. Like, aren't you such a sophisticated person that you would have recognized this is not reality, right?
Like, it's like, you know, you need to experience pain and tragedy for it to have value, right? Think about these Oscar movies that win, like these actors and actresses are supposed to be doing like physically challenging or emotionally challenging things in order to like be worthy of art.
I think there was literally just like a couple days ago an interview with Jacob Tierney, and he was saying how like characters on the shows aren't allowed to like have sex and be happy. If they have sex, they must suffer.
And, you know, he said it in the you know, in the milieu of like queer narratives.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But I think that is also that is pervasive throughout, you know, hetero narratives too. Like, you know, the whole cliche of like any sort of like thriller or horror story, it's like the girl that has sex is the one that dies.
Mm-hmm.
That's
like
really...
Sarah Michelle Gellar in I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Yeah. And that example of this of a trope that is this, and you know what to expect when you see that. So I think there's something really subversive about the vision that Heated Rivalry presented in contrast to all of these things that we are primed to expect.
Yeah. So you get into that a little bit in your article about anti-dystopian art. So tell me now, like, how does Heated Rivalry like check all those anti-dystopian boxes?
Yes. So a friend of mine is a futurist. Her name is Monica Bielskita, and she put together a few years ago.
What is a futurist?
So a futurist is like what Monica does, for example. She's actually worked with movies, movie studios. You know, if you're a movie and you want to create a vision of the future for like some future, you know, sci-fi thing, like, what is that going to look like? The world building of that.
Got it.
So that's kind of the idea. And so she put together what she called the Protopia Futures Framework. She had this kind of like these dimensions of what Protopia is. And I took a similar approach in how I wrote my essay because it's structured into these three sections. And the first one is sex and pleasure. The second one is connection and intimacy. And the third one is joy and creativity. These are all aspects of what is kind of the antithesis of this dystopian worldview. Because even if you think about something like creativity, if you think about the street in a sci-fi future vision, are there murals on it? Is there like actual human creativity that is constant everywhere? Mm-hmm. Do you see that in the future? And so I took these kind of dimensions of leaning into sex that is actually pleasurable and full of mutuality, rather than so much of the sex that we are exposed to in media, which is non-consensual sex we don't actually want to see. It's like disturbing, right? Mm. Why is it beamed into our eyeballs? So
that's why I couldn't watch the Game of Thrones. It was just all
correct
assault. Yeah. And yeah, it's awful.
And that's entertainment. Be entertained.
People
so
love it.
I took those dimensions as kind of the like anchor points around which to tell the story of how Heated Rivalry approaches creating the experience design of its world and of the show that you're experiencing through these very different lenses relative to, you know, what a typical sort of dystopian cynical view would be.
Is there something about something that makes something like anti-dystopian art versus just like happy and fluffy?
Joyful, yeah.
Or is it the time we're living in that makes it as such?
I think in the case of Heated Rivalry specifically, I think it was just such a dramatic departure. And yeah. It's evidenced, I think, in the way that I'm sure you guys have seen this too, where if you watch people's reactions to what, when they talk about what they were thinking or expecting to happen as they were watching the episodes, even up until the very last minute, literally, our heroes are riding off into the sunset together, and people thought that there was going to be a car accident.
Mm-hmm.
And through, you know, people thought that their phones were going to get hacked and that their messages were going to get leaked and they would get discovered, or that, you know, Shane being, when he comes out to his parents, that that was going to end in some sort of traumatic kind of way. And I think at every given moment, throughout this arc of the show, where we are just so primed to expect these tropes to head into something devastating, it took the decision to be like, but what if actually something positive happens? And not something saccharine and like hallmarky, because there's still a lot of like emotional depth and emotional complexity. It's not just on the surface of things. And so I think it's treating the positive and the good potential outcomes with the same depth and nuance as you would the sort of the sophisticated dark outcomes. I think is a big part of that. It's that difference of like, it's just a Hallmark kids kind of show, which this is definitely not, versus, you know, like that kind of like prestige entertainment that actors want to get awards. You know, they think they're going to get awards for, and it lets them emote and stretch their craft, right? This is that for sure. Yeah. So it has that element of sophistication and depth and nuance, but it says, but what if we explored also positive things happening? Yeah. In the way that they do in people's lives.
Yeah. You know what it is also, I think, is that like you do feel that sense of like your stomach swooping, like something bad is going to happen because the setting, right? You're like, it's a professional sports. You're like, okay. And then it's like a queer story and you're like, oh. And then it's like an immigrant from a not very LGBTQ friendly country. You're like, oh, like it feels like it's like setting up for these red flags of tragedy to happen, and it doesn't happen. You know, I was thinking about the difference between maybe like Ted Lasso and Schitt's Creek, which to me evoke similar feelings of happiness and joy if either of you watch those shows.
Yeah.
And what makes it different, I think, for me, I mean, although Schitt's Creek does have a really strong queer story through it, but it's like, it feels like there's all these like possible places where tragedy is going to happen by the sheer setup of the story. Mm-hmm.
I do think a lot of it is just how we've been primed. Like there are templates to writing movies, like act one, act two, act three. It's a 5-act structure. This is the beat that has to happen by act two so that you get the payoff in act five, da, da, da. And there are very sort of expected things that transpire. And also, especially, and a lot of this has been talked about kind of in the current entertainment environment in terms of like, you know, we're all on our phones when we're watching shows. Mm. And so how do those shows need to respond to that with ever even more intensely cliche, you know, things that they give us as we keep watching shows that are, you know, outputted through the same template and movies that are outputted through the same template, kind of we as audiences, we know what we're going to expect. And so it's, I think a lot of it is also playing and subverting that. It's subverting our own expectations that come from a place of us existing in a media environment that has taught us what to expect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Because we've been conditioned to expect the worst, honestly. Mm-hmm. We get so few pieces of media and art that make us feel pure joy. This is why this one hits on such like a visceral level. Do you think that there's anything about the anti-dystopia genre or art that gets like delegitimized because it's associated with a feminine genre? How like the very thing that makes it so powerful is what gets dismissed as unserious? I know we talked a little bit about that, but do you have anything else to add?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of conversation that has gone on around like specifically the romance genre. I wish anti-dystopia was a genre. Like
it needs to be. Maybe this is it. This is the beginning.
I think what this show does lean into are tropes that are very expected sort of romance genre conventions in a good way. And that obviously is a genre that is completely dismissed as unserious and unworthy of any kind of like serious consideration, mm-hmm. Because it is primarily created by women, consumed by women. Mm-hmm. And obviously anything that is primarily created by and for women is de facto unserious. I actually think the really interesting part is in the adaptation is the way that the female characters were expanded in the show relative to the book in like really, really nuanced and profound ways that they showed women where, you know, at any given, again, from the like the sort of trope expectations, at any given moment where you could have expected, oh, this is the villain. This is the person that's going to stand in the way of, this is going to be the foil that is the obstacle in the way of the relationship that the two star-crossed lovers we want to get together are going to have. At every given point that could have been where it went, it didn't go there.
In your essay, you say, you describe cynicism as prophylactic. And actually, this really spoke to me. Diana, I don't know if it speaks to you because we are very different people, but both of us have this very common thread. And I think this is why that makes us like not just friends, but like effective partners and things like this. And, you know, stuff that we did like worked on from like a activism portion. You know, you said cynicism is prophylactic. And I always told Diana, like, I'm the kind of person that isn't doing what I'm doing because I have this like rosy vision of the world or this innate sense of optimism. I'm like gritting my teeth and like pushing, you know, like I have a streak of like the misanthrope in me. I feel like I'm like, you can do better, humanity, you know? And I have that sense of cynicism as prophylaxis in my head because it's protective, right? It is protective. So like, tell me a little bit more about that and how that ties into what Heated Rivalry is kind of subverting.
So the way that cynicism is prophylactic is that it keeps us from feeling anything too much, right? It's like, well, if you expect the worst anyway, and nothing can ever be better anyway, you sort of protected yourself from disappointment, but you've also precluded yourself from being able to actually feel what it feels like when things really do go well and the embodied sense of that. And actually, when I was writing that, I was thinking about there's a show that it's like these very sort of like superficial characters. And on one of the episodes, this other character showed up who's like this very sweet, sincere, genuine person. And one of the characters like didn't even know what to do with this. And as they were sort of just kind of like starting to open up to this person, the show killed him. He died in an accident. So, haha, joke's on you. If you feel anything, it's going to be bad. It's what a silly, naive thing to have thought that you could be allowed to feel something real. That cynicism protects you from venturing into this territory where you could get hurt. The whole arc of the show is just like such deep, genuine emotion and yearning and desire that is really authentic. It's not like objectified desire. It's very real. And we, you know, we go through the ups and downs with these characters as they kind of get in their own way and deny themselves. And at the end, they are able to get past this. They're able to have genuine conversations that lead to this real connection. And the takeaway from that is that this is possible. If you follow what you're really feeling and don't try to mask it and don't try to protect yourself from your own feelings and desires, good things are also possible from that.
Yeah. You know, I've always said that dystopia was my most favorite genre. I consume dystopia, all of it, all the time, since like probably high school, maybe even before. And then when I was teaching, most of the literature that we expose students to in the curriculum, right, because, you know, the curriculum is pretty much set, is dystopian literature. Like 1984 and Animal Farm and Brave New World, The Lottery. I mean, everything we read in high school, even maybe in middle school, is dystopian. And often my students, I mean, even Great Gatsby, I mean, it's not dystopian, but it's depressing. And my students always, it never failed, every year, they'd be like, why are we reading all this depressing stuff? Like, can't you give us something happy? I guess my response to them was like, well, this is where you're learning, right? Like, you're learning through these, like, ideas of what the world could be like if we don't do something about it. To me, it always almost like a warning. It's warning you to what might happen. But I was reading your article. You said something like it, like, desensitized us and it conditions us to accept what is already happening, right? It's not even like you read the dystopia, you learn from it, and then you prevent it from happening. It's the opposite. You read the dystopia, you are conditioned to understand it and expect it to happen. And then when it does happen, you're like, okay, well, I read about this, so this is just so how it is. Yeah. Right, like it makes sense. I guess because I haven't, or we haven't seen too much anti-dystopian art or things that bring you so much joy. You mentioned, Anusha, like Ted Lasso, so joyful. Why is it so popular? Because it is so joyful, right? When you see that, I think that's why, like, it hits you on such a level, like we said, right? Because, like, you're so not used to it. Like, watching The Handmaid's Tale, like, after the first two seasons, I couldn't do it. Like, I finished it. Eventually, I did finish it, but I skipped, like, 2 or 3 years between because I said to my girlfriends, like, I can't. It gives me such anxiety. We're living in it. We're living in it. So why do I also need to see it on TV on top of already living in it?
Yeah.
The really interesting question is, think about all the people that it takes to create that. Like, it takes so many people to bring that vision to life. And, like, what is that, like, what is that experience that it's creating, not just for the people or making that world, but for the people who are consuming it? And that vision, like, how many people did it take to put that vision into the world that lets people essentially thematically experience brutalization of women? For what? To accomplish what? Like, we learned something we didn't know? Like, we know.
Yeah.
We know. We've seen it. We've heard it. Like, when you said, like, presents a violent, degraded world, has likewise turned sex, a fundamental aspect of humanness, into a plot device for violence and degradation, right? So, like you said, pleasure becomes torture in these in this dystopian world.
Yeah.
So I, like, really enjoy dystopia. But right now, it just, as you said, it feels like this bleakness is, like, completely unending and unsolvable sometimes. And, you know, you're like, oh my God, should darkness just win? Because I'm so exhausted. I joke to our friends, like, if a la Matrix, if, like, the AI wins and then we're in the sleep pod, you know, and I'm like, my brain can finally rest, you know, I'll probably, like, drain the system of energy while it re-energizes me. But it just, like, you just want to catch your breath, right? Yeah. That's what I mean. Yeah. You're totally. Like, it's just, I just need to breathe. It's not nihilistic because I don't think I'm that. It's almost like you have this fatigue for these, you know, kind of like really thematically heavy, but really, truly a tragic dystopian futures, right? Because it really feels like at this moment you're living it and you're not really sure how to get out of it or if we'll get out of it. I think for me, that is such a key thing because it has depth and you know, intimacy, personal stakes, but you don't feel like you have to, you know, save the world while you're in it. You know, it makes the world small enough. Like, it, you can have the spectrum of human emotion and it just be about these two people kind of living sort of pseudo normal lives.
Well, that's the thing that I wrote kind of at the end, is that what you experience with Heated Rivalry is something that feels very different. Like, like, literally in your body, somatically, you feel this journey that you've been on with these characters. And you know, I talk about it, it's like you've literally just, like, experienced falling in love. Mirror neurons are firing. You have been on this journey with them. And what it shows isn't the possibility of a future that looks different and looks so futuristic, and how, what kind of crazy contrivances can we think about what could happen? It feels different. Mm-hmm. It feels different from how we're used to entertainment making us feel. It feels different from how just any given thing we're looking at on our screen, be it entertainment media or news media, anything we're seeing on our screen makes us feel. It feels like a crazy futuristic experience. Mm. It's so different from what we're having now. It can only possibly exist, even though the show is, I guess, set in the past, but it feels like a departure from the present, and our minds sort of think of that as a future.
It's sort of like bittersweet to think about. Like, are we so aching for just this, like, small stories with deep personal connections? And the answer to that is yes.
Do you think that anti-dystopia, A, you mentioned that it's not a genre. Do you think it can be a genre? And is it contagious? Like, will we get more of this? Mm. Because, you know, you mentioned in your article that, like, Hollywood basically does not do this. Whether they can't or they don't think people want it, whatever that may be, I think this proved to them that people want it. But I do wonder, like, is Hollywood going to take this and say, oh, this worked. This is like a winning formula. We want to do this. Or are they going to say, like, oh, it's a one-off. This can be made here, right? Like, what do you think?
I think it's definitely too big to ignore that there's something here. I don't know to what extent Hollywood, the Hollywood system, would understand what it is particularly about this that created this kind of reaction. And also, to some extent, it's kind of like lightning in a bottle. Like, I think there's going to be a very heated interest in romance, for sure. It's too big to ignore. And I was just watching this old interview with Jacob Tierney from, like, from 2022. He's talking about, like, himself personally. Really has a huge distaste for power dynamics in sexual relationships. Mm. And like he says, it's a huge turn off for him. And that is a very kind of unique perspective when it comes to the entertainment and movie and TV tropes that we are exposed to, because we're basically spoon-fed Cinderella from the time we're children. And that is sort of the template of, you know, this power disparity comes with hand in hand with romance. Mm-hmm. And I think something that is so particular about the success of Heated Rivalry is that it leans into showing romance in a way that we just really don't get otherwise. People were like, you know, I would see people like, I just finished Heated Rivalry. What else can I watch that's like this? Mm. And I'm like, yeah, right?
Nothing. Nothing. Not this.
But listen, I tried watching, and I did. I watched Bridgerton, the next one, because I used to love it. I watched it.
Yeah.
Speaking of power dynamics, speaking of Cinderella's story, this season is the Cinderella story. They're literally retelling Cinderella, and I am watching it. I liked it. I enjoyed it. I really did. It was the first thing I've enjoyed since starting, you know, my fandom here. But I'm just watching it. I'm like, again? Like, again? The same exact thing? And then the way it ends halfway through, I'm just like, this is why I love Heated Rivalry, because this is nothing. This is not scratching any romantic itch at all.
I think that there is something really universal In the same way that people do seem to like power dynamics within the sexual context, I think people also really don't like it. And there's a whole
perhaps
kind of
we've been conditioned to like the power dynamics.
Have we been conditioned?
Just like we've been conditioned to like dystopia.
Seen?
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, and it's not even, it's, to me, it's like you can have these things that occur in your sex life, and it doesn't have to like translate into some sort of like archetype of this is where you are, like this is the, you know, hole you fit in. Well,
we're keeping
girl,
that
girl, we are not editing that out. That is staying.
That is staying.
Oh, God. I didn't even. Yeah. A box is what I meant. This is not the box.
I don't know if that's better. We are keeping all of this. Audience, enjoy. Unfiltered, unedited, Anusha.
Wow.
Welcome. Welcome to our podcast, Jenka. This is the stuff that we usually cut out, but not this time.
Not this one. Oh, my God. Right. Like, you can have times, like, it doesn't have to translate to your entire life or your entire dynamic. You can have moments where one person is maybe in a different role and then it can reverse. To me, I think that's one of the most interesting things about the way they depict Ilya and Shane's sex life, because clearly Ilya is more experienced than Shane and it's very clear right away. Yeah. But it doesn't become some sort of treatise on their entire relationship.
And it doesn't become a way for Ilya to exert dominance. It's so clear that he is so conscious of this potential disparity that he seeks to neutralize it because it's a turn on for him to do that. Mm-hmm. And the thing about Shane is, like, as he says to Rose, like, he's getting exactly what he wants out of this relationship. And do you know how much, like, power and assertiveness you have to be able to get exactly what you want out of a sexual experience? Like, Shane's getting it. So like, all of these situations where power could be wielded in a way to create disparity is neutralized because it turns the people involved in it on to do that.
And if that's not anti-dystopian, I don't know what is.
There we go. Jenka, thank you so much for joining us today. I loved our conversation. I love your article. I read it 4 times because apparently I do that now. I reread and rewatch things multiple times.
Yeah, Diana's never looked at anything twice before and now she only does that.
That's not true. I mean, you should see my copy of 1984. But anyway, so in your article, you end with how Shane says to his parents, "We just want a future." And you say, Jenka, you say that he speaks for all of us. You say heated rivalry has broken through the onslaught of pop culture visions that make dystopias, cynical, joyless futures seem inexorable precisely because it is a piece of art that is not only shows us, but allows us to feel that another world is truly possible, that lets us somatically experience a future beyond what exists now, a future we all actually want. Joy in the present makes joy in the future seems plausible. And that, too, is hope. And I just, like, love that. I love that for us.
Because we all just want
such
hope.
A great article. Yeah. When you said, "I'm writing an article about anti-dystopia," I'm like, oh, I'm like, yes. It's perfect. Like, I was like, it's perfect because this is what we're all feeling. This shift of, like, seeing dark, 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 living in dark, 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 and getting this light, this joy. So I thank you for writing it. And I thank you for coming on our podcast and for giving us your time.
This was such a pleasure. I loved having the opportunity to discuss the stuff that, like, previously was just, like, in my head. So I'm happy.
Thank you so much. Have a great evening. We'll talk soon.
Yes.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
So we have arrived once again to our moment of sunshine, which is very apropos given that we've been talking about dystopia and anti-dystopia. So I'm going to go first. Okay. I'm going to take it.
Shocker.
My moment of sunshine is an entire evening. We had a Galentine's party.
Oh, you're taking my moment of sunshine.
Listeners, it actually was Diana, because everyone in our group has ADHD and no one can commit to plans. We often need Diana to mother hen us into a plan, because if it was us, all we would do is just, like, say, let's just show up somewhere.
Yeah, let's go to Philly on a Friday night with no reservations, with no plans. Let's just figure it out. Oh, also, it's Valentine's Day weekend. We're just gonna show up somewhere. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yes. Credit where credit's due, Diana planned the entire Galentine's and did a fabulous job, which is why it's my moment of sunshine. And because I'm this generous, I will let you share this moment with me. So it can be our moment.
Is this my Galentine's Day present?
This is better.
No, you know what? I'm taking it. I'm stealing it. It was an awesome night. We went to see a burlesque show. We went out to dinner. We had margaritas and tacos. It was delicious. It's a good moment of sunshine. And it brought us so much joy, like so much joy. I'm still like joyful from Friday night.
The restaurant was just so fun. The food was delicious. The entertainment was fantastic. But if we're really talking about anti-dystopia and the antidote to the hellscape that is our world, feeling present in a moment, laughing and connecting with your friends, like that checked every box. So it was just really fun.
Next week on Everyone Deserves Sunshine, we're talking about queer representation.
This one is at the heart of the show, obviously. And we're going to have a guest to help us unwrap all of the things.
The show. All of the strings.
All of the strings, all of the things. So we're excited. We're excited. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to say hi to the girls in the crease, find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Threads at Everyone Deserves Sunshine.
And email us at everyonedeservessunshine@gmail.com because we love your emails and we will always respond. New episodes drop Mondays.
See you then.